We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church. Welcome to the first episode of Season 3 of the Confronting Christianity podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Sam Albury about friendship. In case you haven't come across Sam, he's a pastor, apologist, speaker, and author of a bunch of books, including Is God Anti-Gay?, Why Bother with Church?, What God Has to Say About Our Bodies?, and Seven Myths About Singleness, which I think might be my favourite of his books. It's just so good. Full disclosure, I'm recording this intro after interviewing Sam because the last time I tried recording an introduction to an interview with Sam, we both ended up giggling so much we had to do 5 takes. Though, to be fair, we did have our mutual friend Rachel Gilson in the room as well, so I'm assuming that it was probably her fault, but not taking any risks. That was the intro, and now I'm going to chat with Sam. Hi, this is Rebecca McLaughlin, and I am joined by my very British friend, Sam Albury.
Hey, Rebecca.
Why did you say hey? You're meant to be very British.
Well, I don't know. I didn't think that part through ahead of time. I'm sorry.
I advertised you in the trailer for this season as my very British friend. So I'm hoping that
you're
going to say...
What does very British mean? What's the difference between British and very British?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I just mean British, but I'm exaggerating for rhetorical effect.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have other interesting things to say. So,
well, being in America makes me feel more British than I would have felt being in England.
Yes, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
It's the process of Americanization that makes us more British than we ever were to begin with. But I am excited to chat with you, not just because you're a fellow Brit, although that's always a pleasure, but also because I want to talk about friendship. And you were a dear friend of mine. So that's one reason why, but it's not actually the only reason why. I'm glad that you don't yet have your endorser's copy of my new book on friendship, Sam. You don't, do you?
I'm not making that up.
Okay.
No.
I'm glad because I wanted to tell you that I actually dedicated the book to you.
No.
I did. Yeah. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One of which is that you, in the process of writing that book, were an excellent friend to me. The listeners won't know this. Well, actually, they will if they read the book, because I talk about it in the book. But there was a point when I was honestly ready to just say, I can't do this. Like, this is all too difficult. Like, it's too complicated. It's too personal to talk about friendship, because I'm not just talking about something abstract, but this, you know, real thing in life. And I thought, I just can't do this. So I remember texting you and saying, I'm thinking maybe I should just pull out of this contract. And I don't know if you remember this, but you replied and you just said, don't you dare. And you kind of taught me off the cliff. But it was lovely in the midst of writing a book on friendship to have a moment of thinking, okay, actually, yeah, this is one of the things we need our friends for, is those moments when we just don't know that we can do the thing that God's calling us to do, whatever that thing is, actually. And we sort of need each other to give us that little nudge and that boost and that, like, keep going kind of thing.
Well, firstly, I'm really touched and moved by that. That is so very kind of you.
Well, I'm glad you're not embarrassed, because it's too late.
No. No, and I do remember that moment. I remember thinking, well, if she doesn't publish this, I'm just going to publish it under my name, because I think it's great content.
Changing a few pronouns along the way.
No, and I think it reminds us, doesn't it, that even you and I, whose work is quite solo, writing a book is a fairly solo endeavor in many respects, but none of us can do the things the Lord has for us on our own. We all need the encouragement of Christian friends. And so much of the New Testament vision for friendship is based around encouragement, by which we don't just mean saying nice things to each other, but actually saying things that will help the other person persevere in their service for the Lord, keep going, keep at it, and not lose heart. So I'm very thankful if the Lord has used me in even a small way to that end with your ministry.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes it's saying nice things and sometimes it's saying sort of not nice things. I mean, well, love sometimes means saying to your friend, actually, I think right now you're behaving sinfully. Mm. Or, you know, get off your behind and do the thing. Like it's not always a sort of mushy and gentle, but I think it's vital. And I'm kind of curious for your perspective on this, Sam, because my impression is that for many Christians, and this may be true for other folks as well, but I think especially for many Christians, we can feel like actually we ought to just have it all together by ourselves. Like we shouldn't really need friends. We should be perfectly kind of self-sufficient, maybe a good friend to other people, but we shouldn't need the help of friends.
Yeah, it's as if they're the kind of, what do you call the little wheels you put on a bike when a toddler's learning how to cycle?
I think in England they're called stabilizers, but I've no idea what they're called in America. You know what? I think they're called training wheels.
Training wheels, stabilizers.
Maybe I do know.
It's that kind of thing, isn't it? Sometimes we feel like, well, in the early stages of life, we need that. We need those friends around us. But part of adulthood is needing other people less, being more self-sufficient, more self-contained. We don't see that anywhere in the Bible. We see the opposite of that in the Bible. But I think that is part of the Western narrative. We're very individualistic. And I think that the kind of narrative a lot of people assume is the older you get, particularly when you get married, I think that that's the sort of, okay, I've graduated out of being part of the gang. And this is now my relational life. And being married means I'm not supposed to need friends now. So maybe we make allowances for those of us who are still single and think, well, of course they need some friends, but those of us who are married, surely we don't, because we've now got married life.
Yeah.
But the Bible shows us all of us need friendship. I remember a good friend of mine, dear friend of mine, when he started dating his now wife, and they were beginning to get to the stage where, like, okay, this is for keeps, and he was beginning to realize this was someone he was intending to marry. I remember him saying to me, quite unprompted by anything I had said, but he's saying, Sam, in case you're thinking I might need your friendship less, I'm probably going to need it more when I become a husband, because I'm just going to need you to, you know, help me be a good husband and be someone I can talk to and someone who's praying for me in this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was actually chatting with my husband a couple of nights ago about this, because this, I think one of the reasons why actually, not only biblically, but I think sort of experientially, like marriage is not designed or supposed to fulfill everybody's, you know, relational, emotional, social needs, like in all its entirety. It's meant to fulfill some of them for sure, but certainly not meant to be the be all end all, nor are children. And I think I was saying to Brian, my husband, you know, part of the reason or part of the way that I kind of see this working out in my life and in the lives of others is because you have a particular kind of responsibility in relationship to your spouse or to your children. And in relationship to friends, it's not that you don't have any responsibility towards them, because we actually all have responsibility toward each other in the Lord, but it's just a different kind of relationship. And so you can actually, I think you can receive challenge and encouragement differently and sort of vitally from friends.
Yeah.
I think you can play in certain ways with friends that's a bit different than in the kind of
context of family. There's a sense of safety, isn't there? Safety both meaning it is safe to have a hard conversation, because there's already a kind of proven security of love. But then also safety, like you said, to play as well. And for the goofy side to come out without sort of feeling like that's, you know, going to be frowned upon or rejected or something.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that playfulness certainly can and I think often does in healthy ways sort of happen in the context of marriage. But it's, I think the reason that I'm feeling toward the language of responsibility is that, you know, if I called you up or if I called another friend of mine up and I said, I am wrestling with this big decision in my life. Mm. You would enter into that with me as somebody who's sort of side by side, but that decision most likely isn't going to have like massive implications for your, you know, you don't have to relate to that decision in quite the same way that like my husband has to relate to it.
Yeah, I'm not going to be living and dying by what you decide.
Yeah, so it's just, I don't know, there's something there, even apparently I read a book on friendship and I still haven't feel like worked through all these things.
But at the same time, it won't directly impact me in the way it would impact him. But one of the signs of friendship is you emotionally and practically involve yourself in the lives of others. So you living in Massachusetts, me living in Tennessee, whatever that
is a bad plan.
Whatever that hypothetical life decision is, it's not going to affect my day to day, but it's going to affect me.
Yeah.
Because you're my friend. And therefore, I like you said, there's a responsibility then for me to give deep thought and to try to give wise counsel to you in that decision. Not because it's going to affect me in lots of practical ways, but because I have that responsibility to you as a friend.
Yeah, no, that's very true. The scriptures, I think one of the reasons I wanted to actually write about this was thinking, oh, there's so much richness and resource in the scriptures that applies to friendship that I feel like we often don't mine. And I'm curious, as you think, Sam, about your own life and friendship, like where scripturally do you go? Like what are the passages, what are the places that give you real encouragement or challenge when it comes to friendship?
Well, you didn't ask me to say this bit, but one of the reasons I was excited about your book is you've given me many more places to go to now. But up until now, my kind of main go-to places have firstly been the Book of Proverbs, where there's just so much wonderful wisdom there about friendship. And the second place is John 15, where Jesus says, I've called you friends.
Mm.
And then he goes on to explain why, because all I've heard from the Father, I've made known to you.
Mm.
So that verse in John 15 has been very foundational for me, because it shows me Jesus thinks friendship consists of disclosure.
Interesting. Yeah.
That is what makes us friends with him now, is he's disclosed everything. He's spilled all the beans.
Yeah.
That fits in with Proverbs and other places in the Bible where friendship is kind of, that's where you tell your secrets to, is your friends. And to think, okay, that's what we have going on with Jesus now. But if that is Jesus' understanding of friendship, it's not our culture's understanding of friendship, and it's not how we default to thinking about friendship. And so one of the questions I'll sometimes pose when I'm speaking on this is to say, according to Jesus' definition of friendship, how many friends do you really have?
Wow,
as in, how many people do know what is going on the inside of your life?
Yeah, yeah. The embarrassing parts,
the humiliating parts, the shameful parts. Mm. And there's vulnerability and cost and risk to disclosing certain things to friends. But what a gift when you can do.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in our culture, friendship is something much less than that. It's just someone you have a superficial enjoyment of hanging out with or something like that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I feel like in our culture, there's a value placed on self-disclosure, even to a sort of embarrassing degree, like where we, more than I think, you know, many past generations, people are inclined to go online and, you know, bear their soul to the world in ways that can almost feel too much. Or I don't mean that in a sort of mean or judgmental way, but more, I'll sometimes see somebody posting something online and think, oh, I really wish you had a handful of close friends to whom you could have said that.
Mm.
Because it's not that I think less of you because of what you've disclosed, or that it was too embarrassing or whatever, or too personal. It's more that it wasn't something that the whole world should have had access to, actually. It's something that group of people.
The internet following someone may have on social media, that isn't their friend. It may be comprised of some people who are, but it can give us a sort of fake sense of intimacy and disclosure by blurting things out online, actually, which it doesn't create intimacy.
No.
Because you're not speaking to a physical person.
Yeah.
And depending on the content of it, sometimes it's done in the name of authenticity.
Mm.
but it can still be part of how we're curating a given image, or we're wanting a certain response. If I say this, then maybe I'll get some sympathy, or, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're actually looking for intimacy and love and to feel seen online, which is just a very dangerous place to look for it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, from the thousands of people who don't actually know you and aren't ever going to love you, like really, even if they become a fan or whatever. I feel like I often have the conversation with my kids about why very famous people who others envy are often profoundly unhappy.
Mm.
And I think it boils down to that exchange that can sometimes take place between real, close, in-person relationships with a few that's kind of ends up being traded for a massive following of people who are, it's just fundamentally emotionally unsatisfying. And not really how we were built to be. I'm curious, I mean, you brought up Jesus's words, which I'm a huge fan of, funnily enough.
I hope so.
And
that reminds me, there was this, I forget who now, but someone was quoting this notorious professor of theology at some big secular university who would occasionally use the notorious phrase, "Now, Jesus said, and I happen to think he's right."
Right. Yes. No, I meant more that Jesus, I think Jesus in the Gospels gives us a mandate and a model when it comes to friendship. So he calls us quite specifically to love one another like he loves us, and then says those stunning words, "Greater love is no one than this," mm-hmm. that he laid down his life for his friends. Which honestly, I mean, I feel like in most church contexts, we would have ended the sentence very different. You know, we would yes. have said, "Greater love has no one than this than the love of a husband for a wife," or "Greater love has no one than this than the love of a mother for her children."
Yeah, the movie genre of the first half of that word is definitely romantic.
Right.
Rom-com, big gesture, yeah. You know, that kind of, yeah.
Yeah,
wedding, this is the wedding moment.
Yeah, and yet he is anchoring it in his own sacrifice for his friends who at that moment, I mean, one of them has just gone out to betray him at that moment. Peter is about to deny him and Jesus has just told him that. So it's words spoken in the context of profound, I mean, not disappointment because Jesus knew, but like actually profoundly being let down by friends. And he says that there isn't any greater love, which I feel like I sort of reflect on that more and more, not to say that scripturally friendship love is therefore sort of more important than married love or more important than parent-child love, but that actually it's on the same level in a way that I think we often don't recognize and lean into as believers. And then we see, it's fascinating to me how Jesus, even on that same night that he's just told Peter that he's going to deny him three times, he still takes Peter, James, and John with him when he goes to Gethsemane to pray. It's like, it's extraordinary, really. I mean, this little group he has of people who he's brought along with him all this way, and he's going to stick with, even though they aren't going to stick with him.
Yes, and again, it shows that for Jesus, friendship does not merely consist of, have you performed enough to qualify for my friendship?
Yeah.
Because like you said, they're about to deny him. The rest of them are going to scarper pretty quickly. Yeah. None of them are going to be there for him. But they're still his friends.
Yeah.
Based on what he's doing for them.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we tend to be more calculating in our own view of friendship. Is this someone I'm going to get enough out of? There's a kind of cost-benefit analysis going on as to when we meet someone like, are you worth being my friend? Jesus doesn't have that calculus.
Yeah.
Thankfully, otherwise none of us would be his friends.
Right. Ever since Jesus' female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. one of the reasons, Sam, I wanted to chat with you about these things is that you're a man. And I think, I mean, I don't really buy into the idea that men and women sort of wholesale relate to friendship differently, because I don't, you know, I think that whereas there may well be average kind of differences in our psychological makeup, I don't think they're sort of essential to the maleness or femaleness of the parties. But I'm curious for your reflections as a guy on, and somebody who is much better friends with many more men than I am, what would you say are the biggest challenges and opportunities that you see among Christian men in terms of friendship?
Yeah, it would be hard for me to compare those to the equivalent for Christian women, because obviously I don't have any experience of the latter. Yeah. But so I'm not saying this is more the case for men than for anybody else.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it is the case for men. But certainly there's the challenge of making friends after a certain point in life. This is something that lots of people have written about and identified, that it gets harder to make friends after you've kind of really started down the career path, after you've begun a family of your own. Your capacity and availability is diminished, and also your opportunities for meeting the kinds of people who might become friends have diminished too. So there were some articles I remember reading a few years ago about how hard it is to make new friends when you're a middle-aged man. And so that basically means if you don't stick with the gang you had at university, you move somewhere else, or you just don't keep up with them, you are less likely to have friends, because you either carry on with the friends you did make before you were middle-aged, or you don't have any, because it's very hard to make friends once you are middle-aged. So that's one factor.
Can I just press there a second?
Yeah.
When you say it's hard, so there's the constraint of, you know, whether work or other family responsibilities. Tell me just a little bit more about why you think it's hard or harder to make friends.
I think it might be, and these are all big generalizations, obviously. Mm. Women are typically more relationally attuned than men are. We tend to be a bit more task-oriented. I think women tend to find it easier to strike up the kinds of conversations that lead into friendship. Mm. Men, those conversations come in time, but they normally, there's a longer on-ramp. There has to be a bit more, normally bonding over some activity that takes place first. It's a longer process to get to that stage. And I think Western culture hasn't served us well, because it's distorted whatever those propensities might be into sort of make, you know, men aren't expected to make friends.
Interesting.
And to need friendship, perhaps in the same way we might expect women to make friends and need friendship. So we're not in a place culturally that's helping us with this. Within the Christian world, church should be the place that is making it easy. And so part of opportunity as churches is to think, what can we do to actually make it easier for men to make good friends? Because Proverbs tells me that it's going to be hard to be wise in God's world without good, sensible friendship.
Yeah.
So church is meant to be a place where there is more relationality anyway, where there is more openness anyway, where there is less risk at being vulnerable, not no risk, but less risk, that should be sort of setting the sort of scene where, it's not unthinkable to make new friends. You know, as you know, I moved cities and countries and continents recently, and I've been surprised at how quickly relationally I've settled here. And the vast majority of that, not all of it, but the vast majority of that is through my local church. My dearest friendships here have almost all come through my church here. But it helps that we already have a culture of trying to encourage honesty, encourage openness, encourage sharing, that doesn't make you feel like, oh, I'm not supposed to be talking from my heart if I'm a man.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
Whereas a lot of people still have that kind of cultural thing of, men aren't supposed to have feelings, let alone talk about them or share them with other people or things like that.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's interesting how sometimes those gender stereotypes kind of become self-fulfilling prophecies, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you tell all the men, by the way, you're neither meant to have feelings nor to need to share them with your friends, then funnily enough, they might not do that.
Yeah, because no guy wants to think they're being unmanly.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, again, Jesus is showing us as well as he's showing us what it means to be the image of God generally, he's also showing us how to be a man.
Mm.
So his openness and letting in of his disciples into his own inner life is a cue for us men especially to take in our own relationships.
Yeah, I think that piece of sort of need and vulnerability is maybe where for all of us we need to kind of recognize, oh, I do need friends, but it's going to take real intentionality. And perhaps this is the piece that becomes more and more true the further we go on in life. It's going to take real intentionality to put in the time and effort to build those friendships. Because I feel like there's an extent to which we all wish that somebody would just suddenly kind of show up in our church or neighborhood or whatever, who was like instantly our sort of friend soulmate, who would understand us perfectly from the beginning, and you know, everything would go swimmingly from there. And
I think part of it as well is, even when we know we need that kind of friendship, particularly those of us in the Western world, our default setting is still, I'm looking for other people to be something to me more than I'm thinking about what I should be being to other people. So we're still kind of scanning the horizon, thinking, who's being a safe person for me? Who's being who's there for me? Rather than thinking, am I being someone who would make it easy for other people to be honest? You know, I remember, I think it was a sermon Tim Keller preached on friendship from Proverbs, and talking about how Jesus is the perfect friend. And he was talking about the way to get the kind of friend we want is to be the kind of friend we want. And we can be that kind of friend when we've received that kind of friendship from the Lord himself. So rather than sort of waiting for everybody else to notice us and make those first steps towards us, is to think, well, actually, how can I be proactively being that for other people?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the penny really dropped for me on that a number of years ago, when I realized that instead of sitting around and thinking, who's going to love me, I actually needed to get up and think, who can I love?
Yeah.
And there's an extent to which we can all sit around thinking, who's going to love me like this, and wishing that everybody else would take all the initiative and recognize the very special person that we are, and all those things. But instead, we kind of need to flip that around and think, who in this room, who in this church, who in this neighborhood could I show Jesus's love to? And if I'm focused on that, then that is a glorious end in itself. But also in my experience, sort of love tends to come boomeranging back one way and another. Like, maybe not in a sort of tit for tat, one for one kind of way, but the more that I'm focused on loving other people rather than sort of sitting around, you know, lamenting my own lack of loveliness, the more I'm actually building those relationships.
And similarly, the more you love other people thinking, I'm loving you because I need you to love me back, or I'm hoping you will, people can tell that. There's something kind of, again, calculating about the love you're showing. That's easy to sniff out. But in my experience, the more we are focused on other people and trying to be there for them, like you said, the more we find we do receive love. But when the goal is receiving love, it's very hard to find it. When it isn't the goal, actually, it just happens naturally. But if we aim for it, we're unlikely to reach it.
Yeah, and I feel like that's so true of many other things in the Christian life. You know,
you only get it as the byproduct of something else.
Yeah, and I think in particular ways that's true of friendship. I had some fun just thinking about the metaphor of fellow soldiers that Paul uses a couple of times to describe, you know, men he clearly deeply loved and had close relationships with. And thinking about, okay, fellow soldiers aren't off on a jolly together, you know, going on vacation and having fun. They're off on mission. They are fighting together. They need to train together. They need to face the enemy together. They need to have each other's, like, literally have each other's backs. And in the context of that, they form these incredibly deep and powerful relationships. And I feel like it's tempting to sit around thinking, oh, I wish I had these like deep and powerful relationships, when actually what we should be doing is focusing on mission and coming alongside each other in that mission. And as a byproduct of that, we then discover that we have those deep and powerful relationships. The kind of the Frodo and Sam experience for the Lord of the Rings lovers out there, where they went from being effectively kind of employer and employee to best friends because of suffering together, like to having a mission, a shared mission together.
That Psalm, I forget which one, Psalm 30 something, I think, where it says, "Come magnify the Lord with me."
Mm.
I mean, that you can apply that in lots of ways, but one of them is, come be my friend. Let's together try and bring glory to God.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can build a friendship on that. I can't build a friendship on, I need you to meet my emotional needs.
Right.
That's too small a thing to build a friendship on.
Yeah, it is too small a thing. I also think, depending on your emotional makeup, it can become too exhausting a thing.
Yeah.
You know, if there was one person, whoever they were, that I was expecting to meet all of my emotional needs, I mean, I pity that person because there's a lot there. But if instead I'm sort of focused on serving the Lord alongside brothers and sisters in Christ, there's something really kind of freeing and intimate about that, actually. Yeah, as we go on mission together. Sam, you and I are a boy and a girl who are friends, and in a beautifully uncomplicated brother-sister way. We have, you know, probably helps that if either of us were not Christians, we'd likely be married to somebody of our same sex rather than the opposite sex. So there's sort of some natural kind of lack of complication in our friendship. What are your thoughts on how Christians can approach friendship with people of the opposite sex, even once they're kind of adult, or maybe even some of them are married, others are not? How can we think about male-female friendship with wisdom and holiness and without just kind of fear and like flee the building kind of scenario, worried that we might mess up?
Yeah, I think that the two things we shouldn't do is the first is what you just said, to think we let's just not even try because it's too risky. The second is to think there's no problem at all. There's no need to be concerned. Let's just jump in without thinking about it. The Bible calls us to be brothers and sisters together. Mm. It doesn't call us to be nothing to one another as men and women. So I am to see that the women, particularly in my church, but in my wider friendship circles as well, as sisters.
Yeah.
So I'm to relate to them in a way that would shows that there is something between us. There is something meaningful between us, akin to if we were biological brother and sister.
Yeah.
So, and it's, you know, Paul says to Timothy, treat younger women as sisters with purity.
Mm.
So again, you get the positive, treat them as sisters with the additional, there's another factor to be aware of here. There's the need to be pure in the way you're doing that.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that to, you know, treat older women as mothers with purity, because that's probably less likely to be a problem when there's a big generational gap going on. So we are aiming for something positive and not merely trying to avoid something negative.
Yep.
There may well be times, kind of nuclear option moments, where you think, I just don't think I can have a healthy friendship with this person. And therefore, let's just acknowledge that. We'll have a perfect relationship in the age to come and call it quits for now. And if we're just only going to do each other's heads in, or there's going to be some inappropriate affection or something, let's just, you know, that's okay. Let's just call that quits.
Yeah.
But that to me should be a very last resort. I'm hoping that by, you know, the fruit of the Spirit includes self-control. So that I think the biblical expectation is let's be godly enough to have a healthy friendship.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, what that looks like for every person will vary according to so many factors. You mentioned, you know, where we unconverted, our lives that have played out in a very different direction to the ways they have. I think the fact that we don't live next door to each other is another thing that's made it a very easy, uncomplicated friendship. I think if we were neighbours and therefore running into each other all the time, I'm sure we'd figure out how to do that in a way that was good and fun and healthy, but it would be a bit more complicated to figure that out.
Yeah, isn't it?
Most of our interaction is through our shared ministry, you know, spheres and that kind of thing. If I did live next door to you, I'd want to be friends with you and your husband together.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I highly recommend.
I'm sure he is. I think I've met him once in passing or on a Zoom or something. But there's a few couples where I've just been on vacation with three other friends. Two of them are a married couple. And this particular couple, I'm friends with them as a couple.
Mm.
And I'm friends with each of them. I have a friendship with each of them that has its own integrity too. And I love that. I can hang out with the wife for a period. I can hang out with the husband for a period. I can hang out with both of them for a period. And each has its own integrity as a friendship that is both fun, edifying, and healthy.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned neighbours, because one of my closest friends is almost a perfect neighbour to me, as in geographically. Yeah, and in fact, she and her family are going to move into like literally the house next door for the coming year because they're doing some renovations. And she is the person who every week we have a deal where we go for a walk together one evening, and we're each other's like prayer and accountability person. So I tell her all my stuff. She tells me all her stuff. And we are kind of mutually charged with telling the other person when they're in sin or when we're concerned that we might be heading towards sin or whatever it is. She's not, I mean, it's actually kind of helpful that she's not in all the other parts of my life, and that she's actually doesn't go to the same church as I do. And we don't have, you know, we have some overlap, but it's not I think any relationship that's kind of too many different zones all together can become trickier. But I'm curious for your thoughts on the value of that kind of relationship, where you have a more sort of structured friendship with somebody who, yeah, you just have like an accountability relationship with.
Yeah, I think we need it because James 5 says, confess your sins to one another.
Yeah.
Not just to the Lord, but to one another. There needs to be another human being alongside you that you are confessing your sins to, who knows the things you may struggle with, knows the weak points in your heart. So we definitely need that, because the Bible says we do. We will need it in slightly different ways, varying from person to person. I have two particular friends that I spill all the beans to, and others who it's less structured, a bit more ad hoc, a bit more occasional. But if it comes up when I do see them, I'll probably tell them too what's going on. But we don't have the kind of, it's less intentional. But I think we all need someone where there's a bit of intentionality with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And depending on the thing we struggle with, depending on our temperament and many other things, we may need more than one person because it may be too intense if only one person knows all the mess that we're struggling with. It may be the kind of thing that's more healthily shared with two or three or four.
Yeah.
So just as you were saying with that friend who's moving closer to you, you know, if she was overlapping in every area of your life, that might be a bit much. We need a plurality of good friendships that can often either guard against things becoming overly intense or things becoming overly dependent. Is to think, okay, yeah, I have this person, but they're not the only person I feel I can share everything with.
Yeah, absolutely.
That can be a good help as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a super helpful note for us to end on, because I think the more that I've sort of dug into the scriptures and thought about what is the relationship or the difference between a friend relationship and a marriage relationship, because of course, you know, it's perfectly good and appropriate to have an active friendship with your husband or wife if you're married. You know, it's not like there's no overlap there at all. Sorry, my daughter is sending me tons of messages which are making weird noises.
I thought that was the closing credits music.
No, the weird music. The relationship, the marriage relationship is intentionally and kind of by design an exclusive one. And it's exclusive in a very sort of particular way. Whereas the friendship relationship is intentionally and by design, actually, I think, a non-exclusive one.
Yes.
To where, as you say, having more than one person who really, you know, knows the secrets of your heart, knows the things that you struggle with, knows your kind of embarrassing moments of failure, etc., that's actually where health lies. And I think for some of us, some people are going to struggle on the one hand of like, oh, it's hard to even open up to one person. Like it's hard to even kind of get off the ground in terms of developing deeper, more meaningful friendships. I think others of us, and I'm probably more like this, the challenge is more to kind of make sure that my eggs aren't all in one basket, that I kind of need to make sure that I'm diversifying. And there have been times in my life when that's been sort of an active, like something I've really needed to work at, rather than just being, oh, this is naturally going to happen, that it's easier for me to say, okay, there's one person who I'm going to expect to sort of know all my things.
I think that distinction is so important. Friendship being, it isn't a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
You know, me and my really good friend, if a third friend comes along, I don't get less of my other friend's friendship, which is the opposite, as you say, to married life. It's often the early warning sign that a friendship might be becoming unhealthy is where we don't want to share it.
Yeah.
And we only ever want it to be just the two of us, and I'm never going to tell someone else what I'm telling you, that kind of thing. That means we're slightly shifting the architecture of the relationship into more of a covenantal thing that should be expressed in marriage, not in friendship.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much, Sam, for chatting with me. I feel like I could talk to you for the next 3 hours about friendship, but for the sake of our listeners, I will wrap it up there.
It's a pleasure to be on, Rebecca. I'm honoured by your friendship. You are a wonderful friend to me. One of the features of our friendship that it'd be quite fun just to share is that you are one of the only people I will ever send a first draft of something to. And I know I've seen a couple of first drafts of something you've said.
Indeed. That's
those of us who try to write words coherently, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very, very grateful to God for you. Thank you for
your
friendship, but thank you too for the hard work in writing a book that's going to serve so many of us.
You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. And if you liked this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. Feel free to include a question you'd like to see explored in future episodes. And join me next week when I'll be interviewing an Australian friend and scholar, Danny Treweek, about how singleness points us to Jesus just as much as marriage does.